Golf Today.
Golf Today on a Monday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch. Golf Week Magazine. Big Monday ahead, including the expected release of the PGA Tour schedule for 2024. But right now we have some breaking news. Let's welcome in Rex Hager, senior writer at Golf Channel. Rex, what can you tell us?
Yeah, Damon, there was a two-page memo that was sent to both the USGA and the RNA this morning. It was sent by the World Alliance of PGAs. That's essentially all of the major PGAs from around the world, including the PGA of America and the PGA of GBNI. Now, in this memo, they essentially pushed back, like the PGA Tour did just a few weeks ago, on the MLR, the model local rule that's been proposed by the USGA and RNA. Essentially, the idea here is to roll the golf ball back for players at the elite level. Now, the reason the PGA is pushed back is kind of tiered here. The first and foremost, they point out in this memo that golf is probably the most popular now as it has been in decades. You look at the momentum that they gained throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, and they're afraid that anything we do right now would be a fundamental damage to what the game could be 10 years from now or 12 years from now. It's also important to point out that the PGA of America is speaking as one voice. That's all of them. That's the World Alliance of PGA sends a very clear message to both the USGA and the RNA. There is no ambiguity on this one. They clearly aren't in favor of this rule. In the memo, they also question some of the data that's being used as far as how they're going to move forward. Is it going to be 10% less for the elite players? Is it going to be 15% less for the elite players? So this certainly sets the stage for what's going to be a showdown between the USGA and the RNA, and it seems like the rest of professional golf.
Rex, why do you think this memo is sent out now? Because there is still 1 week to go in the notice and feedback period that the governing body set 6 months ago.
My understanding is they've been working on this for quite a while. This goes all the way back to Royal Liverpool at the Open Championship when a lot of these bodies got together and met. And as you and I both know, it's hard to keep these things a secret. Let's go back to the framework agreement that was announced on June 6th. I think that's one of the few secrets that we've seen in professional golf in a long time. So on this front, they probably could have waited another week, but they felt like they needed to get ahead of it. They needed to make their stance clear on exactly how they feel about the MLR, and they clearly created a solid voice, a unified voice.
Rex, the USGA and RNA have been trying to build support in this distance rollback. Did they get out over their skis just a little bit in the fact that they don't have the support of the PGA Tour and now the PGA of America and this World Alliance?
I'm sure they tried to build support, to be fair. I don't doubt that if you look at what they've done over the last year, really, to be as open and the communication lines between all of the organizations has probably been more fluid than it has been in the history of the game. But I don't know that they were ever going to count on support specifically from the PGA Tour. I'm sure we talked about this just a few weeks ago when the tour responded to this with their voice, which was they're against the rollback. PGA Tour players had pretty much spoken with one voice. I mean, there's a couple of exceptions, but by and large, most tour players did not want it. And I think the PGA of America, at least specifically, you listen to what Seth Wall said at the PGA Championship just a few months ago, their CEO. He made it clear that he didn't want anything to happen that could potentially impact his members, impact the game. It's a member organization. So I don't think there should be any surprises that this played out the way it did.
The memo, Rex, asks for the consultation or implementation of any modified rule to be pushed, what they refer to as significantly past 2026. Are we looking at a scenario, if this is adopted on January 1st of 2026, where three majors will be played that year under a modified ball, but the PGA Championship would not?
I feel like that's certainly a possibility when you look at the way, and I hate to put it this way, given where we are in the game of golf right now, but when you look at where the lines have been drawn between the two essentially organizations, you have the USGA and the RNA on one side. You would assume, like I think you and I both are doing, that Augusta National is going to follow suit with whatever the MLR is going to be. And then clearly on the other side, you have the PGA Tour and the PGA, just not America. You have all the PGAs across the globe, pretty much. And I think you can see a scenario where you would play a PGA Tour schedule and at least one major championship under one set of rules and three majors under another set.
He's a senior writer with Golf Channel, Rex Hager. We appreciate his time and this breaking news. Now we have this memo from the World Alliance of the PGA, this to the USGA and the RNA in summary and as a potential solution. We respectfully ask that you consider pushing back the implementation of any rollback, thereby maintaining the status quo significantly past the current contemplated dates. We believe this to be the best approach towards a truly collaborative industry proposal and potential alternatives to the thorny challenges of bifurcation. It will also allow the time to arrive at a consensus on the proper data to consider as the game grows and evolves. Eamon, I thought it was interesting that in Rex's report just now that they contend, meaning the World Alliance of PGA, that it's that not all of the data necessarily is correct, or at least at the very minimum needs to be challenged.
It is, and then they actually have the cheek to say that the momentum in the game will be somehow halted or impacted by this, which, again, where's the data on that one, guys? It's, you know, you can't make a data argument when it suits you and then just put out these spurious assertions when it doesn't suit you. This shouldn't really be a surprise here. And when they're asking for the implementation to be pushed back significantly past 2026, what they really mean is never. That's ultimately what they're getting down to here. It's delay, 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 which has really been the tactic for those who have been opposed to this move by the governing bodies for quite some time. And I'm not sure why we need an extended consultation period, which actually began 3 years ago. You remember this was the quaint news story of the day in golf right before the pandemic. This is what the USGA and the RNA had announced back in 2020, and that conversation started then. So we are 3 years into this process now. We're only since March 14th into the official notice and comment period, and presumably all of this information that the PGA Tour, the PGAs around the world have forwarded to the governing bodies as part of that consultation period. But then to jump the gun a week before the end of that consultation period seems a little bit out of order in a way. But I'm assuming they've passed along this information before. But the idea that this is somehow hastily being presented to people in the world of golf is a bit of a sleight of hand, because it has been a long conversation.
It has. The game stakeholders in many areas, leaders, men and women, have worked together on a number of fronts, especially during COVID, post-George Floyd, for example, ways to grow the game. I'm just a bit surprised that in this distance rollback proposal put forward by the USGA in RNA, that they didn't find a way to get Jay Monahan, who runs the most aspirational tour in the world, the best tour in the world, and the PGA of America and the World Alliance of PGAs, of course, in the country, 28,000 men and women who teach, who lead and inspire, that wouldn't get them somehow rowing in the same direction on this. In some ways, I feel like the game is stubbing its toe. We've seen the fractious nature of PGA Tour versus LIV, and now we have another instance where we're just seeing that where the game is so popular, seemingly, people playing more, that this is another instance where there's going to be, you know, some push-pull and some pretty strong disagreement.
It's hard to get organizations rowing in the same direction when they are member organizations where a lot of their members are commercially incentivized to row in the opposite direction. Which I think this is has never been popular with players. We have seen some players voice support for the idea of a rollback, or at least a pause on golf ball technology, but not many. You have a lot of guys opposed to it. And the PGA Championship has always been seen as the most player-friendly of the major championships. They are always effusive in their praise of Kerry Hague's setup every year. And quite the opposite to, for instance, the governing body, particularly the USGA, which is always targeted as somehow trying to embarrass players out there. So it's not surprising that there would be a willingness to go along with and side with players on this one. But the problem is the PGA Championship is also very clearly seen as fourth among four in the major championship. Does it get further diminished if it is perceived as not being in that top tier anymore simply because of a difference in the golf ball that's played? We already have a players' championship. We don't need another one. And that's the danger and the risk for the PGA Championship, is if they are perceived as somehow being a little bit less than the other three major championships, should they choose to go ahead and play this modified local rule ball.
Great point you make, not to mention what the equipment companies want to see happen, you know, let alone the governing bodies and the leaders of the game.
There's a lot of voices and only two choices right here, Damon.
Back on Golf Today, recapping the news from earlier, the Alliance of PGAs, which includes the PGA of America, sent a memo to golf's governing bodies, the USGA and RNA, pushing back on the proposed model local rule to potentially roll back the golf ball, saying in part to consider pushing back the implementation of any rollback until past the currently contemplated dates.
And the USGA has responded to that memo from the World Alliance of PGAs, saying we remain in a notice and comment period, accepting feedback from voices from across the game. The PGA is an important stakeholder, and we appreciate the feedback they have contributed to this conversation. And Damon, that feedback period officially ends August 14th, 1 week from today. It was 2 weeks ago that the PGA Tour said that they weren't going to abide by any modified local rule. Now there's this pushback from the Alliance of PGAs. What's your reaction in terms of how meaningful is this in terms of the strength of the voice?
I think it's a very strong voice. I think it's in a different way as strong as the PGA Tour stance. I've always been wary, Eamon, of bifurcation. I think the game of golf operates best under one set of rules. The game is aspirational, even for the 10 handicap who's trying to become a 5 and maybe become a 2 or a 1 and qualify for a mid-AM or a U.S. women's AM. I mean, I think the game thrives when it operates under one set of rules. So I just think it's a little bit dangerous, and I'm a little bit concerned should that ultimately change.
Whereas I struggle with the idea of bifurcation, to begin with, I think it's aspirational to the point of slightly delusional that we play under the same conditions and rules as the elite players in the game. And there are a lot of points that are made in this memo that are actually meritorious, particularly how is such a rollback policed in the future in terms of tournament use and turning essentially PGA of America members or other PGA around the world, turning them into enforcers of a rule that the USGA itself can devise or the RNA can devise but not actually have to enforce. That's a significant issue to have there. So we shouldn't actually make light of the fact that there are serious issues of the governance and implementation of this rule that would require a lot of work from people who aren't actually writing the rule. But in terms of the broader idea of forcing the best players in the world to give a little bit more, is that make the game less one-dimensional, which is what distance has done, if you're on that side of the argument, well, then you can make a very compelling case that this rollback ought to happen. But that shouldn't dilute the reality here, that there are a lot of implementation questions that are raised in this memo. I just think it's a little bit too hasty in terms of the release of this memo, and it positions the PGA of America as being just, I think, a little bit too much in the players' camp on this thing. They are a bigger stakeholder in the game than simply coddling the affections of players.
But was the USGA and RNA, was their timing off a little bit? Was this a kind of a dissonant chord in an already fractious time in our game professionally, whereas in the grassroots level, the game seems to be thriving? Why now?
Well, it's not now. It was 3 years ago when they started this conversation. And in fact, you can trace the conversation back even farther than then. So the game wasn't as fractious and divided when this process began or this conversation began as it is now. But the reality is on either side of this argument, doesn't matter where you are. If you favour the rollback, it should have happened years ago. It's not soon enough.
Sure.
If you oppose it, now is never the right time. Mm. It's like, let's find another way to push it down the road because there are too many complicated questions on it or too many stakeholders would be disadvantaged by making that change now. So never the twain will meet with those two sides on this. So I think arguing over the timing of it, while slightly interesting, kind of defeats the purpose. It seems as though the governing bodies are somewhat set on this idea of January 2026, and the Masters has signaled their support. Fred Ridley was fairly clear on that in his press conference in April.
We'll see what happens in the spring. Well, from distance to one of the straightest hitters of all time, is going to check on this date in history. All the way back to 2016. Do you remember Jim Furyk shooting the first 58 in PGA Tour history during the final round? Travelers, TPC River Highlands. Finished minus 5, hit every fairway and every green in his record-setting round. At the end of his round, by the way, I interviewed him. He had 85 text messages on his phone. 85 for Mr. 58. Sunday at Live Greenbrier, Bryson DeChambeau fired a 12 under 58. And prior to this, DeChambeau had only broken 60 once, carding 59 in a pro-am at the Shriners Open. And Eamon, I mean, the man played out of his mind yesterday.
It was an impressive round of golf, that's for sure. I imagine that as the years go by, more people will claim they were there to witness it than actually were there to witness it.
Probably so. And you want to talk about the notable 58s on pro tours. In fact, in pro golf, there have been 13 58s at least that we know of. 157, by the way, David Carey shot that on the Alps Tour back in 2019. Rory Sakala was 18 years of age when he shot his 58 on the Japan Golf Tour 2010 Crowns in the final round. And Bryson's round of golf caught the attention of the best player in the world, arguably Jon Rahm. This tweet saying, no matter who or where you are playing, 58 on a Sunday to win is an incredible accomplishment. Congrats to DeChambeau on your win today at the Greenbrier. And after the win, when asked if he expects a call from U.S. Ryder Cup captain Zach Johnson, here's what Bryson had to say. I'm playing really well. I've got some equipment that's performing quite nicely off the driver. It's a deadly combination with my putting. So clearly I putted well, drove it well, wedged it pretty well. You couldn't have written it up better than this, but if I do get a call, that would be awesome. If not, I'll be rooting for them over in Rome. Have Brooks Koepka likely on this Ryder Cup team? Bryson DeChambeau deserve a look?
Well, Brooks Koepka won a major championship against more than 150 other guys, measured himself against the best players in the world. Bryson DeChambeau has won an exhibition tournament in a closed circuit against 47 other guys.
He shot 58.
He did shoot 58. Yeah. 58 is a wonderful round of golf. He clearly is playing well. He deserves all the credit in the world for shooting 58 wherever it is, but he's not going to get a call for the Ryder Cup team because the captain's picks, as we're going to see with Justin Thomas, which we'll discuss later, it's so much about the locker room chemistry as well. And Justin Thomas has locker room chemistry with other guys on the team. He brings that fire, brings that passion. I don't think the same argument can be made for Bryson DeChambeau in terms of the what he brings to the locker room dynamic. And no one is getting a pick for the Ryder Cup based on what they're doing on the LIV Tour. I mean, Zach Johnson's made clear he doesn't even know what network it's being broadcast on, which doesn't make him an isolated figure in that sense. But Brooks Koepka is going to make that Ryder Cup team based on what he did playing against the best players in the world. No one is getting picked based on what they do on LIV.
What about what Bryson did at Whistling Straits? 2-0-1, drove the 18th green, made eagle. I mean, was well-behaved as far as we know. Does that not carry any weight, not to mention the length of his drives?
I don't think it really does carry that much weight. I mean, that was an enormous distraction that week, and he and Koepka were having
their
pecking match
at
each other quite around that time as well. But I think so much has gone under the bridge since then, particularly in terms of Bryson's game and his injuries. Bryson DeChambeau was very clearly among the very best players in the world in 2021 when that Ryder Cup eventually happened at Whistling Straits after a one-year delay. He's not the same player now as he was then. Look at how he's measured himself against other great players. He played pretty well at the PGA Championship. I believe he finished top 10 there. So he is showing signs of form, but he's not showing signs of form consistently enough outside of the closed ecosystem of LIV Golf to really warrant a pick or even consideration.
I walked into these offices this morning wearing a Wingfoot 2020 U.S. Open golf shirt. It was impressive, as was Bryson's performance at Whistling Straits. I think it would be too big of a distraction at the end of the day. As great of a player as he is, I believe, I think too often there is baggage, a little bit of immaturity from time to time from Bryson that we have seen that I think at this point probably would not be additive to that locker room. As much as I respect his game, I don't think that it would be necessarily as cohesive, which is obviously going to be hugely important as the U.S. tries to win on the road for the first time since 1993.
Yeah, and everything's become somewhat muddied by the framework agreement between the Saudis and the PGA Tour in terms of what the reality looks like going down the road. What does the landscape look like for the Ryder Cup 2 years from now? Well, that's a question for another captain. It's not a question for Zach Johnson. And as it is now, he already has an embarrassment of riches for guys to choose from. And I just don't see him complicating his life, complicating the dynamic of his locker room by going outside of the ranking list that he has now to put in somebody who is essentially playing an exhibition tournament, playing it extraordinarily well, but he's in a closed ecosystem. And if you're going to pick guys from LIV Golf, well, you could make a better case for a Taylor Gooch to be on that team than you can for Bryson DeChambeau. I just don't see either one of them getting the call.
Jon Rahm, you know, applauded it. Maybe he's just causing trouble.
Yes, John Rahm's applauding excellence, and that's what we saw out of Bryson DeChambeau yesterday. But excellence doesn't get you a plane ticket to Rome.
Not necessarily.
No, it doesn't. Well, it's AIG Women's Open Week, and we're going to be joined by one of the great fairy tale winners in recent memory. That's the 2020 champion, Sofia Popov. If she can do it again, it would be an even more impressive victory. And we're going to explain why next.
Back on golf today. A couple Sundays ago, Frances Céline Boutier won the Amundi Evian Championship for her first major title and became the first player from France to claim the title since the event was designated as a major. She said she was going to, like, enjoy the rest of the season. Nothing pressing after winning such an emotional title for her. But you know what? She kept her hot streak going yesterday, winning the 3D Group Women's Scottish Open for her fifth victory on tour and second straight. Boutier is the first to win back-to-back tournaments on tour since Jin Young Ko in 2021.
And she's also the first player to reach at least three victories on tour this season, Damon, following the LPGA Drive-On Championship and the Amundi Evian Championship held off Hoo Joo Kim. She shot a great final round 65 to finish at 13 under par. Ronin Yin, a major winner this year, also in the mix with a final round of 66. And with that victory, Boutier reaches some rarefied air in terms of winning a major championship and following it up by winning the next event. Inbee Park did that 10 years ago, going from the KPMG Women's PGA Championship to win the Walmart Championship in Arkansas. And Arya Jutanugarn in 2016, coming off the Women's Open, won the Canadian Open in her next start.
About this week, final women's major of the year, the AIG Women's Open, will be played. One of the top clubs in England, Walton Heath, hosts the best players in the world. Gorgeous golf course, tough golf course. And it was at this event in 2020 that Sofia Popov shocked the golf world, closed the 3 under par 68 to finish at 277, two better than Jasmine Suwanapura and four better than Minji Lee. Popov started the week as an Epson Tour player who didn't have LPGA status. 3 weeks prior to the AIG Women's Open, she was caddying in an LPGA event.
And Popov has not teed it up on the LPGA Tour since August of 2022. She welcomed her first child, her daughter Maya May, to the world in June. Looking forward to all the adventures with our little nugget, she posted at the time. And it's great to be joined now by Sofia Popov. Sofia, you look remarkably well rested for someone who's got a 2-month-old child. How is motherhood?
Motherhood is a lot tougher than what I look like right now. This is the first day I've actually worn makeup in about 8 weeks since she was born. So I feel a little bit more rested. She's had a pretty good night, but I've heard that I should not get too excited about it because it might backtrack again.
Oh, no doubt. It's only a mirage. Let me tell you, what's more of a bigger jolt to the system, winning a major out of nowhere or those early days of motherhood?
You know what's funny is when Maya was born, I think the first thing I said to my husband, Max, I said, I don't know why I ever got upset on a golf course, because delivering a baby and taking care of it the first, whatever, 6 to 8 weeks is way harder than playing golf. So I don't know. It's a tough comparison. Winning the AIG Women's Open was amazing, but holding Maya for the first time definitely tops that.
Sofia, you had a shoulder injury late last year, which knocked you out for the most of the second half of 2022, and then you were pregnant. So it's basically been about a year since you've made it start. Coming back this week for the Women's Open, do you feel as though you come back with a different kind of attitude, that suddenly golf isn't the most important thing in your world?
Well, I just think that, honestly, everything, having a baby puts everything into perspective. I think, like I said, it's a lot tougher than playing golf, in my opinion, taking care of a human, although I've had so much fun with that. And I don't know, I love playing golf and I'm excited to get back. But at the same time, I enjoy every second or almost every second of being with my daughter. And that takes over right now. And I think also it makes me manage my expectations going forward for sure. But like I said, it puts everything into perspective, and I'm really, really excited to play golf again. But right now, motherhood is my number one priority.
Sophie, you've overcome some serious issues physically in your life, from the shoulder to Lyme disease. Where are you physically in terms of your health?
You know, if you would have asked me 2 weeks ago, I was still struggling a little, but mainly just from postpartum recovery. But yeah, it's, you know, I think everything kind of came together at the same time with the Lyme, my shoulder injury. I think everything, it all feeds off of each other somehow. You know, when one thing's not going well, the other gets worse too. I did have a lot of time at the end of last year to work on my shoulder. My trainer, Andrew Hannon, and I, we got it into a spot where it was, I could have possibly played again, but then I was pregnant. So I obviously couldn't start my season this year. But I think that I'm managing it very well as of right now. And I think, you know, yesterday or the day before yesterday, I was on a golf course again, and I started training about a week ago, and the body's starting to feel better. And but it's definitely just controlling all the symptoms, controlling the shoulder. And I have to do my same routine every day, whether I have a baby or not, which makes it very tough, because trying to carve out, you know, 30 minutes to an hour every day to take care of myself has just been a struggle, and it doesn't always happen. So that is what I'm trying to balance right now.
Well, if you're an elite athlete, you've probably overcome some injury in your life. I understand you watched Andy Murray's documentary Resurfacing, the great Grand Slam champion from tennis. What did you learn from watching Andy Murray?
You know, it's actually one of my favorite documentaries, and I honestly probably shed a tear or two, because it was just so, I think it made me reflect kind of on my own journey with the Lyme disease and trying to recover and expecting it to go overnight, but it takes years. And I think that was what I saw in his documentary and in his journey, is that it takes a while, and he tried to get back and he wants to so bad. I think I don't even know if I know an athlete that is more ambitious than he is and wants it so bad. And so, you know, all these trying to do it again and again and again and realizing he's not ready yet. I think that resonated with me a lot. And just realizing that it takes a lot of time. And that's why I'm also, you know, very happy to see him playing better tennis again. And it makes it more exciting to watch him now.
Sophia, you were one of the great fairy tales with that victory at Royal Troon back a few years ago. You struggled in majors after that victory. Did you feel as though you suddenly had more expectation or more pressure on you after that victory that you felt obliged to live up to?
I think so, yes. I think just the expectations that I put on myself. I love major championships and I enjoy them. And I think what was tough was in 2021, I played okay the rest of 2020. In 2021, I had a good week in Vegas, and I went to the U.S. Open and with a really quick turnover. And I think I missed the cut by one at the U.S. Open. And it kind of maybe also just puts things in your head where you say, you know, I know I should be, my golf game is so much better than this. Why am I, you know, struggling to make the cut at majors now? And I think always the anticipation and expectation coming together, didn't make me play my best golf. Or I actually played good golf, but I think mentally wasn't quite there. Same thing at the AIG Women's Open last year. I felt like I played great golf and ended up missing the cut by one. And, you know, we all know what can happen on a weekend at the British Open. So I think that was kind of disappointing for me, for myself. And it's been a little bit tough, probably more mentally than physically, after winning the Open in 2020.
So how do you manage expectations going forward then?
Yeah, I think that again, just also now with having Maya and also having that excitement about playing golf again. I think I lost that a little bit with my shoulder injury. All through 2022, it just wasn't fun to play golf because I was always in pain, and I think that wore on me not just physically but mentally. But now I've noticed I'm itching to get back, and I just have everyone around me saying, take it easy, take it easy. And I'm like, can I hit like at least a 6-iron? You know, can I, how far can I go? And I think that excitement is going to really help me going forward and just to enjoy playing the game, to be out there to play. I think actually JT said that yesterday after, you know, barely missing the playoffs. And he said he actually enjoyed playing the game again last week. And that resonated with me a lot because I think I haven't had that in a while. So I think that going forward is also going to help me manage those expectations. And just like I said, make me have more fun on the golf course again.
Well, Sophia, we appreciate a few minutes. Enjoy the rest while you can, and best of luck this week. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Sophia will be there. Final women's major of the year to be played at one of the top clubs in England. Walton Heath hosts the game's best starting Thursday, 6 a.m. First round on USA Golf today. Back after this. Golf today on a Monday, Damon Hack alongside Amy Lynch, Golf Week Magazine. We are expecting the PGA Tour to release this new 2024 schedule. But first, some news on this Monday. The Alliance of PGAs, which includes the PGA of America, sent a memo to golf's governing bodies, the USGA, in R&A, pushing back on the proposed model local rule to potentially roll back the golf ball, saying in part to consider pushing back the implementation of any rollback until past the currently contemplated dates. This is the World Alliance of PGA's memo to the USGA and R&A, saying in part, we believe this to be the best approach towards a truly collaborative industry proposal and potential alternatives to the thorny challenges of bifurcation. It will also allow the time to arrive at a consensus on the proper data to consider as the game grows and evolves.
And the USGA responded quite quickly to that statement, saying we remain in a notice and comment period, accepting feedback from voices across the game. The PGA is an important stakeholder, and we appreciate the feedback they have contributed to this conversation. Following all of this for us is Rex Hoggard, a senior writer at Golf Channel, who broke the news of this morning, and he joins us now. Rex, looking at these competing statements and memos, what stands out to you?
Well, first and foremost, I would say that the PGAs around the globe spoke with one voice. Go back a couple of weeks ago to the Open at Royal Liverpool. A lot of these PGAs were in that meeting. That includes the PGA of America, the PGA of GB&I, the PGA of New Zealand, that they all spoke. There were 9 different organizations associated with this memo, and that they did it with one voice, I think, is telling that the game, at least on that side of the golf ball, let's say, is very, very stringent on what they believe. I think the other part of this is not only are they pushing back in this memo with the proposed MLR, which would be the golf ball for elite players, they're also pushing back on the idea of bifurcation, which essentially the MLR would do. You'd have one golf ball for the professionals and another for the amateurs. That was one of the fundamental things that a lot of people who were involved in this from the very beginning felt like was going to have to happen. Because the one thing that everyone made clear is they didn't want to touch the golf ball at the amateur level. So it seems to me that's going to be the bigger impasse going forward.
Rex, the PGA also pushing back on the timing. Is there any indication you have that the USGA and R&A would consider sliding back the comment period, letting things kind of cool and simmer and maybe allow for more discussion among all the parties?
I don't know if the comment period is going to be pushed back. The deadline for that is next Monday, so I feel like they're far enough along that they'll just probably go through that deadline. What this memo, and really the PGA Tour just a few days ago kind of pointed out, is maybe this isn't the best time to implement this kind of change. Essentially what the PGAs have asked for is to delay the implementation of this, pointing out that golf is experiencing unprecedented growth at the moment, going back all the way to COVID-19. And the quote from that memo is they would find that fundamentally damaging if suddenly you introduced a rule that would either bifurcate the golf ball or even roll back the golf ball.
Speaking of this comment and notice period that you referenced, Rex, that ends 1 week from today on August 14th. We saw 2 weeks ago Jay Monahan in a memo to players said the tour would not adopt any modified local rule. Now we have this pushback from the PGAs. Why do you think this has been made public during the comment period as opposed to being shared in that comment period and then addressed publicly after that period is closed?
I think it shows how far the sides are away from each other right now. I mean, if I'm being honest, on one side you have the PGA Tour, and its membership has spoken pretty much with one voice. There's a few exceptions, but not many, against the proposed rule. And on this side, the PGA of America seems to have put everyone together around the globe, just not in the United States. Again, the PGA of America is speaking for its membership, which are club pros, which are essentially the first line of defense when it comes to getting people to play the game more often. So you have those entities on one side, and of course the RNA and the USGA on the other side. There is something to be said for getting the message out there, and I think that's what the PGA of America and the other PGAs are trying to do.
The distance debate has been a huge talking point for decades in our game. We'll see what the USGA and RNA ultimately decide. Great reporting from Rex Hoggard, senior writer at Golf Channel. This statement from the RNA today: we are currently in a notice and comment period where we are listening to views from throughout the golf industry. We appreciate the contributions we have received so far about the proposed model local rule, including the World Alliance of PGAs. What do you think, Eamon?
I'm curious what the deal breaker is in this, because it is worth noting that this Alliance of PGAs did not say we are not adopting this rule. The PGA Tour did say it would not adopt any such rule. They're pushing back, looking for more time. And I'm curious, really, what is the key point of dispute here? Because they pretty much throw everything at the wall. There are eight reasons they give. Let's call it eight ways to no mass in here. But there are eight reasons they give for resisting it, which is that it would halt momentum in the game, which is at best a debatable proposition, but that the data is unreliable, that it would lead to bifurcation, issues for retailers, issues for manufacturers, the policing of it, course ratings, and the idea of maybe it isolates the women's game by not enforcing the same rules there. So there's eight different concerns. They're all complicated issues, that's for sure. And it's really unclear to me what the actual touchstone is here. My sense is it's probably more to do with bifurcation. And whether or not the PGAs, in particular the PGA of America, is ultimately going to make that break from the governing bodies, to me is somewhat questionable still, because they are, as we've said before, fourth among four out of the major championships.
To some. And
to a lot of people. I don't think you're going to find many fans who, in the popular imagination, think that the PGA Championship is the premier of the major championships. If we get to a scenario where it's being played under different rules than the other three majors, since Fred Ridley at Augusta National has signalled quite strongly in April his intent to go with the governing bodies should they adopt, as of January 1st, 2026, a limited flight ball. I'm not sure at this point that the PGA of America is willing to go down that road. But if anything, the game teaches us these days that a year is an awfully long time. We've got 2.5 years to the point where any such modification would be adopted, assuming they don't push it back at the request of these PGAs.
Years a long time. How about a week is a long time in this business? I more or less remember when there was a discussion about a proposed Masters golf ball. Well, I'll tell you what I don't want. I don't want one golf ball that flies a certain distance on the PGA Tour and another golf ball that flies a certain distance in the U.S. Open and another golf ball that flies a certain distance in the PGA Championship. I'll tell you that. I do not want that. Do you think the viewer wants that? Do you want that?
Do you think the viewer could tell the difference? I'm not convinced.
I tell you what. I mean, the players are talented enough probably to figure it out, but I think they probably could tell the difference from a golf ball that, you know, a 340-yard drive from Rory McIlroy in Austin, Texas, that lands 3 feet from the green or 3 feet from the hole, as opposed to a golf ball that, you know, leaves himself a 40-yard uphill chip. I think that would be
We can all
visible
pick
for the viewer.
Outlier shots that kind of reinforce our argument here. I think ultimately the Rory McIlroys and John Rahms of the world are still going to be identified, perhaps even more so, as the best golfers in the world. I don't necessarily see that it's going to disadvantage a lot of guys out there in terms of their skill set.
Yeah.
Although I'm sure there are plenty of players who would argue to the contrary on that. It's, to me, this whole memo seems more like a leverage point to Rex's statement of getting it out there now. It shows how far apart the various constituencies are. And fundamentally, what this is going to come down to, Damon, is should the character of the game be bent to the will of one of those particular constituencies? Is it the manufacturers? Is it the players? Is it the tour, which has its own internal political issues going on now, where it doesn't want to further alienate players? There are a lot of people with a lot of areas that are quite divided in terms of what their priorities are. And I don't envy either Martin's numbers or Mike Wan in trying to figure out what it is. But they've pretty much nailed their colours to the mast in terms of where they intend to go here. We're going to see just how willing they are to kind of help others along the way by kind of modifying the parameters of the discussion.
These are men and women that have spent a lot of time together on Zoom calls and on telephone calls over the last few years on various topics. We'll see if they can find any consensus in distance going forward.
Consensus in this game is a commodity in short supply.
No doubt about
it. Well, the PGA Tour has moved on to Memphis this week for the FedEx St. Jude Championship. Next up, we've got a guest who knows a little something about winning right there at TPC Southwind. Justin Leonard in the house. Stay with us.
And we're back on Golf Today. This week, the FedEx Cup playoffs begin. You can catch live first-round coverage of the FedEx St. Jude Championship from TPC Southwind. Could be hot this Thursday, 2 p.m. Eastern time, right here on Golf Channel. And a guy who knows a thing or two about winning in Memphis, our friend, former colleague here at Golf Channel and NBC, Justin Leonard, back in 05, won the FedEx St. Jude Classic by a single shot, to notch his 10th career PGA Tour win. Showed you how limber he was back in the day. Might still be limber.
Well, a few years later, 2008, he was in the winner's circle in Memphis for a second time. He defeated Trevor Immelman and Robert Allenby on the second hole of a playoff with this 19-foot birdie putt for the victory. The win was his 12th. On the PGA Tour.
Here's Trevor. Oh! Burns the edge.
Impressive career resume for Justin Leonard. The Open Championship back in 1997 at Royal Tour in that final round 65 to come from 5 strokes behind. Also won the Players' Championship from 5 behind. The clinching half point at the 1999 Ryder Cup, which we Europeans don't like to talk about too much. And a storied amateur career. And Justin Leonard joins us now. Justin, thanks for your time. FedEx St. Jude Classic takes place this week in Memphis. It's TPC Southwind, you've got those two victories there. What should we be looking for in a winner, since you seem to know your way around that golf course pretty well?
Well, probably some pretty low scores. I mean, the ball travels great distances in Memphis this time of year with the heat and everything. The first year that we played there, the first year that I won, after they converted the greens from bent grass to Bermuda, the greens were extremely firm. Scores were tough to come by that week. And then, you know, as the greens have gotten more receptive over the years, certainly guys have figured out a play in their beautiful putting surfaces. But it's not a very long golf course. I don't feel like it really suits any particular style of play. There's some great risk-reward holes on it. And, you know, it's the FedEx Cup playoffs. It's just the top 70, so the cream of the crop. And it should be an exciting week to watch.
Justin, how did that move to Bermuda grass help you in your game in particular?
Well, I think that when the greens were so soft, you felt like you had to shoot 63 or 4 every day. And once the greens got a bit firmer where the ball's bouncing and everything, it just really made the golf course that much more difficult. And you had to hit really good quality shots in order to get the ball somewhat close. It's a great surface, though. I mean, putting, it's actually much easier because they're in such good shape. When they were bent grass, they tended to get a little chewed up with the heat and requiring a lot of water. But now the Bermuda, great surfaces. It's just a little tougher to get the ball close. But as we've seen over the last couple of years, scores are pretty good. Those greens hold quite well now. But certainly in the heat that they'll be playing in Memphis, to be able to putt on great surfaces like that, it's just such a bonus. And I think all the players in the field this week will look forward to putting on those greens.
Justin, I had to dig deep for this question and do a lot of research. Is it true that your wife, Amanda, had to convince you to go back to Memphis after you stopped playing there for a couple of years?
Yeah, you know, we're golfers. We're a pretty fickle bunch. And I hadn't had a lot of success there, even though I felt like I should have success. So it kind of fit well in our summer schedule there for a few years. And sure enough, as you saw earlier before we went to commercial, you know, our daughter Reese was there. Amanda, I'm sure she was pregnant. Seemed like she was pregnant for about 10 years at that period of time. But she was pregnant with our second Avery. And I had a big lead going into the final day. And that's why I just kind of collapsed, because it got a lot closer than I felt like it should have. But, you know, it is. It's a golf course that suits me. I enjoyed playing there. You can really need to shape it both directions off the tee, a little more strategic, certainly back then since the greens were so new. But just a fun place. Memphis is a great town. They show up and support the tournament. And then you bring in, you know, St. Jude has been such a long affiliation with the tournament, and getting involved a little bit after I won with St. Jude Children's Hospital and all the incredible work that they do. It just became a natural fit to go back each and every year.
Justin, you got to admire a woman who wants to go to Memphis in the summer when she's pregnant, because that's a pretty stout hill to climb.
It is, yes.
You walked away from competitive golf in your mid-40s. You're now back playing on the PGA Tour Champions. What's been the biggest adjustment in getting back into competitive golf?
I think just kind of getting the right mindset. Look, I've made some mistakes over the last, say, year and a half. And at some points, I was practicing a little too hard, to where I got to tournaments and I was already tired and those things. And so I think I found the balance between practicing and kind of getting some rest, getting into contention a couple times and getting used to that feeling again, you know, making some little technical adjustments here and there, just finding that kind of balance again, has been a challenge. And I think I'm getting there. I wouldn't say it's great each and every week, but I've played pretty consistently, not quite as consistently great as, or good as I would like to, but I've had some good rounds and I'm kind of looking forward now that I've been playing for basically a year since last July, and being able to just focus on golf and not, you know, continue my work with NBC and Golf Channel, although I'll be at the Ryder Cup in September in Rome. It's allowed me to kind of really dig in and try and apply some of the things that I learned watching the game and watching the best players in the game play at such a high level, trying to take some of those things that I learned from a practice standpoint, from maybe more a strategy standpoint, and apply it to my own game. So all of those things, I feel like some of the pieces are coming together. I've got about 7 or 8 events left this year, and I'm really looking forward to these because I think I can apply some of the things that I've learned, hopefully not make the same mistakes that I made kind of last year and early on in this year, and just kind of continue making the progress that I feel like I've been making.
Justin, having shared a meal or two with you over the last few years, I've noticed that you eat very clean. You've taken care of your health and your body, and you work out. How much of an advantage do you feel you have physically anyway in terms of youth and vigor compared to your peers?
Well, I feel like I saved some wear and tear when I was working with you and Eamon over at Golf Channel and NBC, not swinging a club very often for 5 or 6 years. But that's something, you know, my training and workout changed. I did, you know, a couple of very short distance triathlons. I did some kind of endurance ski racing during the wintertime living in Colorado. And now I've gotten into more specific golf training through some great programs that I helped, you know, get to market and those things. And so one thing that I've learned is really the amount of rest that you need, and not just time sleeping, but, you know, yes, working out those things, but also doing some of the cold therapy and sauna and infrared stuff. All of those things, I feel like, take away a lot of the inflammation, aches and pains. And so I do feel, you know, I feel like I'm probably in the best golf shape that I've ever been in. I'm certainly hitting the ball further now than I was, you know, back in 2014 to 2016, kind of at the end of my PGA Tour career. I know some of that's due to you know, golf club technology and those things. But I also feel like, you know, physically, I'm just in a better place. No real aches and pains or any lingering injuries. And as you know, in the game of golf, it's fairly common, especially if you, you know, walk up and down the range at PGA Tour Champions event. Usually most everybody's feeling a little something. And so it's nice to feel good, both mentally being fresh and also physically.
And all those years of working out at altitude in Aspen probably helped you for the oxygen deprivation of sitting next to Chambly on the live from set all those years as well, Justin. Over your left shoulder there, we can see the claret jug from Royal Troon in 1997. You have 9 years of eligibility left for the Open. You haven't played since 2016. It's back at Royal Troon next year. Are we going to see you there?
Yes, you will see me there. I plan to play at Royal Troon. The senior open the following week is at Carnoustie, which, you know, I've lost in a playoff there to Paul Laurie. So I plan to go over and play next year. This summer, it just really didn't work out. We took a family trip. Damon, I did splurge on some gelato, a little red wine, so which is a little out of my side of my norm. So I spent the last like 10 days not only hitting balls, but trying to lose some of the gelato that was consumed. But yeah, I'm looking forward to get back over playing. Obviously, I haven't played Lynx Golf since 2016, but Amanda's been to Troon. My kids have never been there. So it'll be a fun, we'll go over as a family and they'll get to see Troon and relive, you know, something that happened a long, long time ago. It'll be a fun week and I'm looking forward to it.
Gelato and red wine. Now you're speaking my language. I also know some Ryder Cup trophies behind you as well. We all remember 1999. What are your thoughts on Zach Johnson and the American team going to Rome? Are things moving in the right direction? JT, maybe, maybe not. What do you think about this squad?
Well, I think that Zach Johnson has been doing and will do an incredible job. He's got great vice captains. You know, they've all been involved in so many great Ryder Cup moments and a lot of things behind the scenes that you know, we're not even aware of. So it's interesting, you know, with, you know, Liv and there's some players, certainly Brooks Koepka's played well, Bryson played great last week. That certainly deserve consideration. It'll be interesting to see. I think Zach and his, you know, vice captains have probably a couple tough decisions to make. JT being one of those, hasn't had a great year, but golly, came so close last week to, you know, getting into the playoffs, which certainly would have helped his cause. So some tough decisions ahead, but then again, there's always, I don't think there's ever, you know, an easy or a few easy phone calls to make when you're telling players, hey, I'm sorry, you're not going to make this team. You know, there certainly will be some of those phone calls made here in the next few weeks.
Justin, yes or no, would you be interested in being the captain of that Ryder Cup team next time out?
Yes.
Boom.
No.
Spoken
no
like,
hesitation right
spoken
there.
Spoken like a Ryder Cup hero. Thank you, Justin. We appreciate the time.
Gentlemen, as always, thanks. Have a great day.
You too. And as we go to break, just to kind of take you back memory lane, 1999, he was four down through 11, some 45 feet away from the shadows of Brookline into the sunlight. Justin Leonard, the hero. And he will tell you gets asked about that putt nearly every single day. Back on Golf Today. Today, the PGA Tour released its 2024 FedEx Cup regular season and playoff schedule as the tour returns to a calendar year schedule for the first time since 2012. Now, the fall portion of the 2024 FedEx Cup season will be announced at a later date. The 2024 regular season consists of 36 events, beginning with the opening drive at the Century and Sony Open in Hawaii, with the regular season ending at the Wyndham Championship. So, Amy, let's take a look. Here you go. You see the now signature events in white, starting with the Century.
Yeah, the Phoenix Open was last year, but the organizers said they didn't actually need that status. So the Genesis and the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am, along with the Century, will become the early signature events on tour.
Arnold Palmer Invitational. Always a fantastic event. And you see that leads right into the Players' Championship, which is really the heart and soul, the signature event of the PGA Tour. The Masters followed by the RBC. So the RBC Heritage will be a signature event for the second straight year.
And you'll see some opposite field events there. The Puerto Rico Open, the Corrales Punta Cana Championship. That's a recurring theme for broader fields opposite some of the signature fields that have a more limited number of competitors.
Busy spring into the summer here, Memorial, U.S. Open, and Travelers. So back to back to back, huge events on the PGA Tour. You also see the Myrtle Beach Classic. That's going to be opposite the Wells Fargo Championship. That's an additional event next season.
And that Travelers Championship turns out to be the last regular PGA Tour event as an elevated, or we now say signature, event, the Open. Of course, we'll wrap up the major championship season And then the three FedEx Cup playoff events beginning August 15th with the FedEx St. Jude Championship and ending September 1st with the Tour Championship. And here are the notable changes from 2023 into 2024. The AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am becomes a signature event, which involves a format change. The Pebble Beach Pro-Am, the RBC Heritage, the Wells Fargo and the Travelers Championship will all have no cuts. The player-hosted invitationals, which are the Arnold Palmer, the Memorial and the Genesis, are expected to have 70 to 80 player fields with a cut to the top 50 and ties plus a 10-shot rule. Texas Children's Houston Open will move from a fall event to the end of March, and the Memorial Tournament, traditionally held 2 weeks before the United States Open, will be held the week before the US Open and be part of a three consecutive week of signature events. And we're joined now by Tyler Dennis, the Executive Vice President and President of PGA Tour. Tyler, we've heard a lot, even earlier this year, we heard a lot from Jay Monahan about this idea of a cadence to the schedule. Have you achieved that cadence in your mind? And what were the biggest challenges in getting to what we see here?
Yeah, well, hey, guys, great to be with you. And this is an exciting moment because we have this is really the culmination of several announcements and times I've been on previously with you to discuss it. An evolution of our schedule. And we think that we have found a really great model here, and we are very excited about what was announced today. To your question about cadence, that was a key thing that we focused on. And as you were going through the schedule a minute ago, you can see we've got 31 weeks from January to the beginning of the playoffs. There's 36 events, followed by our three FedEx Cup playoffs. And the cadence of the events was really important because every week matters. You know, winning a PGA Tour event, no matter what it is a huge accomplishment. And tying every week together is very important. So the cadence between the full field events and the signature events, how those relate, the eligibility system that you were referring to, it all comes together in what we think is going to be a very compelling and dramatic season across each and every week.
Tyler, this is the first year of designated events. Now they'll be called signature events. A lot of compelling golf was played. What's been the biggest takeaway from the tour and how these events played out in 2023?
Yeah, Damon, I mean, this has been a transition year. It's been really exciting. We identified signature events this year. As you said, we called them designated this past season. And we've seen how it can all tie together. We've had great signature events, but we've also had some incredible fulfilled events. And, you know, I'm thinking of the Honda Classic, the Mexico Open, and last week at the Wyndham Championship, all incredible tie-ins to moving into the playoffs. And a big change, as certainly you've talked about over the last few days, is the playoff field sizes. So it all tied together this year, but looking to next year where we switched over to January to August, 31 weeks, like I said, a very compelling system that has the right cadence of signature events. It has the eligibility system to get in there. You've got the next 10 and the swing five categories so that every player every week matters and they can try to get in the signature events. I think it's going to be a really great product for fans to see in 2024.
Tyler, outside of the playoff events that don't have a 36-hole cut, there'll be five other signature events where there is no cut. Those Friday storylines of players fighting into the weekend. What was the decision around that? How did the tour arrive to that choice?
Yeah, you know, I think the way to think about it is with the change in eligibility where the signature events have a smaller field size and the primary eligibility category is the top 50 from previous year's FedEx Cup. So said another way, the players that get into the BMW Championship a week after this week, that really is the cut to get in special events. That is the drama and the ability to fight, you know, one's way in, whether you're the best player that season or just even in those full field events leading in. So it really ties each and every week together, and we think it's going to be a really exciting thing for fans to watch.
Tyler, your colleagues, most recently Ron Price in the Senate subcommittee hearing, have been fairly open about the challenges of maintaining purses for these signature events. Are you confident moving forward that these purses for these events can be sustained even without outside investment?
Yeah, the product is something we're really proud of, and the value that we show our partners is always something we're thinking about. And we have some wonderful longtime partners on the PGA Tour. And you can see that across the entire list of the 36 events plus our three playoffs. We have our partner in FedEx and other longtime partners. So we feel really great about the value. And, you know, the system that we've laid out is something that is really meaningful to each and every tournament. So it's going to allow the tournament, the title sponsor in each place, to really make the most of the compelling drama throughout the season.
One of those longtime sponsors is RBC. And last week, Sports Business Journal reported that they had re-upped as a sponsor for their two PGA Tour events, but only did so for 1 year pending the outcome of the framework negotiations with the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia. Is there any concern at the Tour that other sponsors might balk at the idea of that kind of association, or that they might base their commitment longer term on how that deal works out?
No, you know, we've been communicating very regularly, Eamon, with all of our sponsors. You mentioned RBC. They are just a fantastic partner in the RBC Heritage, which, as you know, is going to be a signature event this coming year, but also in the RBC Canadian Open. And as it relates to the framework agreement, you know, it's something we're working on hard. We're communicating, and ultimately, you know, we're going to get it right. We're going to get it right for our sponsors. We're going to get it right for our fans, and certainly the communities we play in. So we're very confident about our product moving forward. We're fully sponsored, and we have a couple exciting announcements coming up. But today's announcement really reinforces the PGA Tour product, and that, you know, we think fans are going to be really excited about it.
Tyler, you say you're fully sponsored, but I do notice a couple of areas in the schedule, events, for example, like in Palm Beach, that don't have at least a named sponsor. Where are you in that process?
Well, yeah, the viewers will note that the longtime tournament in Palm Beach at PGA National is on the schedule. As we noted in the release, we're going to have some exciting news on that soon about sponsorship.
I notice there's a lot of information about the pathways into these signature events, Tyler, in terms of the top 10 in the fall series and the top 10 in the FedEx and then the mini series between signature events. One of the main criticisms of the old WGCs was that there wasn't enough churn out of it at the end of each season, that being there kind of kept a lot of guys in the ecosystem. Are you confident that there will be a significant amount of churn among the top 50 who will be automatically eligible for these signature events?
Yeah, that churn's actually one of the things that we identified as the most critical component. And you go back to March when we announced the new competitive system that involves the signature events and the full field events and how they interact. We wanted to be certain that there was the churn for those players who are the hottest players, either of the season or of the moment. And that was really important as we worked with our player directors and player advisory council and others to think about. So as you know, the top 50 category from the previous season, that's the primary eligibility category. But then we have the next 10, what we're calling the swing five, which is coming from the full field events immediately preceding. So that's going to be a significant piece of the overall field that we think is going to make sure that in each signature event, you've got the hottest and best players. And then the final category is everyone who's won a tournament beginning in January. So you're getting the best of all worlds there. Like I said at the beginning, winning matters on the PGA Tour. And we want to get the very best playing against each other in these signature events.
One criteria I'm curious about, is there still the sponsor exemption, or let's call it the Tiger Clause? What if Tiger decides he wants to play in a tournament, Tyler, that he is not eligible for under that criteria?
We did include four sponsor exemptions. They're restricted to PGA Tour members for each of the signature events. So if Tiger wants to play, he'll certainly be more than welcome.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Tyler, one person I imagine happy today is Giles Kibbe, the president of the Astros Golf Foundation. He desperately wanted the Houston Open to get back into the spring. He is now 2 weeks before the Masters tournament. Why was that important for the PGA Tour as well?
Well, you know, Jim Crane and Giles, that you mentioned, in Houston have just been incredible benefactors to the city, reinventing and restoring Memorial Park Golf Course. The Houston Open was long on the PGA Tour calendar, as you said, and really going back to when Mr. Crane first got involved, we we identified that we would like to be able to have that in the network calendar portion of the season, and the stars aligned, it worked out, and we think we've got a great run there between the Players Championship and then those 3 weeks between that and the Masters. It's going to be exciting, and the final piece of it was, of course, Texas Children's coming on as the title sponsor. So really great things that Jim Crane and his team are doing in the city of Houston.
I noticed the tour did not schedule an event against the Olympics next summer, Tyler. And that's obviously an important event that all the governing bodies and stakeholders in the game advocated for, including the PGA Tour. But it does involve a relatively small number of golfers. Was there any discussion of scheduling a tour event that week, or did you decide that week simply too important to go up against?
Yeah, it's the latter, Eamon. When the world of golf got together and talked about getting golf back onto the Olympic program, you go back to 2009, you know, we wanted to go all in. We think it's a really important facet of growing the game across the globe. And so we committed at the time that we would make every effort possible to not schedule an event that week. And as you see, that's what we've done. We've left that open. And, you know, representing your country, getting to be an athlete on a national team is something that for those players who have gotten that opportunity, I think, you know, is an incredible experience. And we want to do everything we can to support that in the Olympic movement.
Last question, Tyler. I'm curious how you find a balance here, because there are always going to be people who say, well, the season's too long, we need less. But at the same time, you guys are charged with providing playing opportunities to all of your members, not just those who are in the signature events. Do you think you've found that balance here in terms of the 39 weeks plus what is to come in the fall series?
We think we have. I mean, you know, it's as you said, it's a balance, and we have to think about the entire membership. But the model that we've transitioned to here with the January to August race for the FedEx Cup, talked about it at length today. We think that's really exciting. The FedEx Cup fall, as you mentioned, I think last time I was on the program, we were announcing the 2023 edition of that. That's going to be incredibly exciting because for the first time as we transition into the fall, you really have some key moments that you're building towards throughout the fall events. We're about to get to experience it here in another month. But it's not just, you know, it's not just fighting to retain one's card. There's all kinds of other things at stake. The top 10 coming out of the fall are going to get access to the first two signature events following the Century. You know, winning still brings with it an incredible list of benefits. So we're really excited about that model. And I think fans are going to get to see an exciting first version of it here in 2023 with the FedEx Cup fall.
Big day for the PGA Tour. We look ahead to 2024. Tyler, thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you, guys. Always nice to be with you.
And you, Tyler Dennis with the PGA Tour. How about the signature events with no cuts in 2024? All but the Century had a cut in 2023. So the Century, AT&T, RBC, Wells Fargo Championship, and the Travelers Championship in our neck of the woods in Connecticut. Now, this statement from Steve John, the CEO of the Monterey Peninsula Foundation. We are pleased to announce that the AT&T Pebble Beach Prom has been designated as a signature event by the PGA Tour for the upcoming year 2024. We extend our gratitude to title sponsor AT&T for an incredible 39 years of partnership that have helped elevate this event to new heights. We also extend our sincere appreciation to the Pebble Beach Company for being a host course since 1947. As we move forward, tournament host organization Monterey Peninsula Foundation remains committed to its 80-year history of supporting nonprofits across Monterey, Santa Cruz, and San Benito counties.
And that's one of the events that's probably most impacted by this in terms of its fundamental nature. It's always been celebrity-heavy, full field. Now it's going to have about roughly 80 professional golfers with celebrity partners, and the celebrities are going to say bye-bye.
Bye-bye by the weekend, yeah.
As well. So, and that was always one of the more kind of well-known days on the PGA Tour schedule was Celebrity Saturday at the AT&T. So I suppose it does indicate what this status means for a lot of events out there.
It does. I think it's a hard lift for the PGA Tour to put a schedule together, especially during these uncertain times and with different levels of player in terms of the star players that you're trying to keep happy, but also the proletariat who's trying to keep their card and want to keep up and have their games and lives respected as well. I remember speaking to Tony Finau earlier this year. I was walking with him down a fairway during a practice round, at Bay Hill. And I just asked him, what are your thoughts on the so-called designated events at the time, now signature events going forward? And he said he loved them. He loved the fact that the best players in the world were playing against each other more often. He thought it sharpened their games, made them more aware of the other, that a Scottie Scheffler would want to know what Jon Rahm is doing, even if he didn't say so publicly, that it brought the best out of the players. And I think in a large sense, we will see that in 2024. I asked Tyler about the no-cut situation. I'm old school in that sense. I think those Friday storylines are important. I loved watching, for example, Justin Thomas chasing it this week and playing his way into the weekend. I love Tiger Woods' 142 straight cuts made. Not all of those were in cut events, for example. But I just, that's my one issue with it. But big picture, I think it's probably a big win for the tour.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I still think you have to be measured against the performance of the field on a given week. And I know the argument has been made that simply by qualifying for these events, it's making the cut. I'm not really buying that argument, though. But I do think the tour has managed to do something here that I didn't actually think was going to be possible in terms of ensuring that the ecosystem isn't closed. And I want to show you how just how this next 10 works that Tyler Dennis just referenced there in terms of how guys qualify beyond the top 50 who make the BMW Championship. The final 10 from the FedEx Fall Standings, which will begin in September, are into the first two of the signature events. Then we have the top 10 from the FedEx 2024 FedEx Cup through the Classic in Palm Beaches will make the Arnold Palmer Invitational. That's when it moves to be the current season, the 2024 season, versus the fall of 2023. And as we move through the year, you'll see that each of these signature events has a cutoff point of the week before, which is the Swing Five, as Tyler Dennis referred to it there, which is keeps the pathways open and it keeps those other non-signature events relevant because those are the means by which trending or hot players can actually make it in to these events. And I had a conversation not that long ago with Aaron Oberholzer, who Aaron had been top 25 in the world, and he said when he was in the World Golf Championship events, if he had a decent, if he had a top 10 finish, a couple of decent finishes in those WGCs, that was often enough to keep him within that ecosystem for the year, even if he didn't feel as though he was performing particularly well outside of it. That was one of the dangers with these events that have been, in effect, elevated into the upper tier of the game. This, to me, is the best-case scenario for not allowing that to become a closed system.
Yeah, much less of a closed shop, much more of a rolling system with players having opportunities to get into the big-time events.